We start today's program with the latest on Child Protective Services. Last night, Children's Action Alliance hosted a community forum, giving the public a chance to express feelings about how to help kids who've been abused or neglected. KJZZ reporter Stina Sieg attended the forum and joins me now. Hi, Stina. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Hi.
Was there a consistent theme? A lot of people went to the microphone to express their concerns. What did you hear?
Well, there were a lot of different ideas. Some consistent things that came out were more support and more money. A lot of people talked about how they felt like they weren't being listened to by CPS. There were foster parents who didn't feel listened to. And then there were also people who were child advocates who felt like CPS wasn't doing enough. There was one woman who was trying to become a caseworker in CPS. She had been a counselor in Missouri, I believe, and she thought that it was very hard to navigate all the necessary requirements to do this, and she'd been trying, I think, for 3 years. So there was just a lot of frustration in the air.
Did it feel anecdotal, or did it feel like there was any consistency to what people were concerned about?
Mostly it was very related to whatever their specific circumstance was about. You know, foster parents cared about foster parents. You know, also we had people who had dealt with CPS or had been former CPS workers talking about how CPS needs to support its staff more. And there was obviously lots of talk about funding. There was one person who directly called for Clarence Carter to resign or to be fired. And that, you know, there was thunderous applause, but it was squelched very quickly by the people who were running the forum. And he was sort of, you know, booted out nicely.
And after the forum ended, you talked to one current CPS caseworker who expressed some things to you?
Yeah, she wanted to remain anonymous. She'd only been a caseworker for 10 months. But what was really striking was, you know, I asked her, like, point blank, if she ever feels overwhelmed or if she feels like she's afraid of getting burned out. And this was her answer.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, more than once, even only 10 months, and I've had the thought, can I do this for a year? Can I do this for 2 years? You know, is it too much?
And Stina, finally, you also talked with the head of this new care team that Governor Brewer has put together, Charles Flanagan. Did he say anything that made you think there's an action plan in place?
He did not elaborate, but he's definitely said he had some ideas. And, you know, I asked him, oh, so how are we going to solve this thing? And he said, oh, I've got some ideas in place and we're building on them and blah, blah, blah. But he was very careful not to make any specific action plan to me, not to make any promises. But he was very clear that he felt like the first thing that needed to be done was to check on the welfare of all the 6,000 plus kids that have been involved in these forgotten cases. And then after that, you know, roll out the action plan, give specific ideas about how to fix things in the future.
KJZZ reporter Stina Sieg, she covered last night's CPS-related forum. You can find her piece online at kjzz.org. Stina, thanks.
Thank you.
And for more on the state of CPS and what needs to change, I turn to State Senator Katie Hobbs, who's also a social worker. Senator Hobbs, good morning.
Hi.
Is CPS in its current form fixable, or does something even more dramatic have to happen?
Well, you know, I think over the years, we've made several piecemeal attempts at reform. If this was on TV, you would see me making air quotes around reform. But, you know, I think that the reform that needs to happen is really big, because what we've been doing hasn't been working, obviously. So I think we need to look at really big approaches, and we need to come to the table with the resources that will make implementing those really big reforms successful.
I'm certain it's a long list, but what are some of your biggest concerns about the problems with CPS? Are there one or two things that just make you sick to your stomach?
Well, you know, as a social worker, I would say that we need the resources to really support those online workers, because I think they're getting the brunt of kind of everybody's frustration. That's not even the right word, but just, you know, they kind of get the brunt of everything. They're doing a really dangerous job. A really horrible job, a really hard job. They're making life and death decisions every day, and they don't get the support they need. And I don't think the infrastructure is in place to provide that support. The turnover is incredible. The morale is pretty low. And if we had the resources to hire much more qualified workers, people that are actually trained and degreed as social workers, then I think that would go a long way to help in that area. That's one area that I think is a huge problem.
You'll certainly have some influence on that when it comes to the legislative session starting in January. Is funding for CPS going to become a real, real tough, intense issue in the next session? And do you think it'll be a partisan issue?
I do. I think you've seen, I think almost all of the Democratic leadership call for increased funding for CPS, supporting the governor's call for additional funds. And you've seen both leaders in the House and Senate Republicans say that that's not the answer. And I don't, you know, I think that funding is certainly not the only answer. I think right now you're looking at funding a broken system. You need to fund a way to fix the system so that it's not broken.
To what extent does more need to be done on the front end, this issue of making sure we have people not abusing and not neglecting their kids? Can more be done as far as that's concerned?
Oh, absolutely. In the last several years, we have cut every single penny that the state spends on prevention for child abuse. We need to be doing so much more on the front end to help families that are struggling stay out of the CPS system, because what we're investing on, what we could invest on that end, is so much less than what we invest on the back end once people are in the system. So we should definitely be doing a lot more to support families so that they don't end up in the CPS system.
And if that additional funding comes into play, and if there is more money to hire more CPS workers, is there enough of a base of qualified CPS workers, folks who will be trained, who will be able to get a running start?
Well, I think that there are programs in place that can address that. If there are worker shortages, you have a partnership with the ASU School of Social Work where they're stipended, and I think it has partial tuition reimbursement or forgiveness, or I'm not really sure all the details, but you can put things in place. And I think if you have an infrastructure that actually supports the workers and people want to go work at CPS, and it's not a career that people don't want to do, then I think that you can address the worker shortage.
Senator Hobbs, does Clarence Carter have to go?
Well, you know, since he's been at the agency, he's been making promises to make these reforms that will fix the problems. And I haven't seen him be able to deliver on that promise. So I don't necessarily have a high level of confidence in his ability to fix what's going on. So I'll just leave it at that.
Well, those who defended him have said that the job is too big to be the director of DES, and CPS mm-hmm. may need its own person who really has authority. Mm-hmm. Is that something maybe you'd support?
Well, I think that option definitely needs to be on the table. I don't know. I mean, I think you have to look at the enormity of the task that CPS has, and it definitely deserves the attention it would get as its own agency. But you can't just say, okay, yeah, let's authorize that. You have to make sure, if that's the direction we go, that all of the resources to make sure that that transition is successful are in place. And that's what I would worry about, that we would say, okay, this is the answer, but not provide the resources to actually make it happen successfully.
We have multiple investigations. DPS is going to investigate. The governor mm-hmm. has appointed an independent oversight group. Do these make sense to you? Do you feel confident about those? Or does it seem like, okay, we need to look like we're doing something?
Well, I think that these task forces are very focused on one specific issue, and that's these 6,000 uninvestigated cases. There was a news story last night that said, you know, these 6,000 cases shouldn't have been a surprise to anybody. They were in these reports that went to the legislature. There's still 10,000 other cases that haven't gotten the attention that they need in the last several months. So the 6,000 cases are the tip of the iceberg, and it's an issue that's taking all the resources right now and focusing on this one little thing when we really should be looking at the bigger picture. So, yeah, so we find out what happened with these 6,000 cases. That doesn't address the bigger problem.
Finally, when you hear certain state legislative leaders say that money won't fix the problem, does that make you more pessimistic about the effort that's going to start, that has already started, to get legislation passed, to get more money going? Is there a belief system that everyone at least realizes what the problem is, and some option will be taken care of, some option will be taken, and it won't just be people are just sort of saying things and not acting?
I think that people need to sit down at a table and put their partisan hats aside, their political agendas aside, and really be willing to get at the hard answers to solving this problem. And I don't have a lot of confidence that that's going to happen right now. The funding's part of it. I hope it happens, and I am going to be right there trying to make it happen, but I don't know that there's the political will to do that right now.
Does the public come into play there? Can the public force a political will?
You know, I really hope so. I get emails every day from people in the public, from constituents who have had issues with CPS. And, you know, it was kind of like the reporter who was covering last night, and I wasn't able to be there last night, but how everybody has their own experiences and that colors their perception. But every angle you can think of, I get emails every day from people who have had, issues, and they think this is the problem, that's the problem, whatever. But all of those perspectives are really important in addressing this issue. And I hope that the public doesn't stay quiet about it. I hope the public doesn't say, oh, there's another task force, they'll fix it, and then we can go on.
State Senator and social worker Katie Hobbs. Senator Hobbs, thanks for the time.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll look at the economic forecast for 2014 for Arizona's economy and the national economy. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by St. Joseph's Hospital Heart and Lung Institute, offering a new FDA-approved treatment for the symptoms associated with acid reflux without pills. Appointments and information at 602-406-4000.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. BBC NewsHour comes your way this afternoon at 1. It's going to be cloudy and quite a bit cooler today in Phoenix. We've got a 30% chance of rain this afternoon, and our high should get up to just 63 degrees. Around the state right now, light snow and 25 degrees up at the Grand Canyon. It's snowing and 27 in Flagstaff, cloudy and 34 in Prescott, mostly sunny and 66 degrees in Phoenix. In Tucson. It's 62 degrees in Phoenix right now at 11:19.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Projecting how quickly Arizona's economy would recover from the deep national recession seemed to be an exercise in optimism. The state had always been one of the best at bouncing back rapidly and confidently, but job growth is still well behind the national average, even as housing is strengthening. It's against that backdrop that the 50th Annual Economic Forecast Luncheon, hosted by ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business and J.P. Morgan Chase, is being held this morning in Phoenix. In a few minutes, I'll find out what J.P. Morgan Chase Managing Director James Glassman has to say about the national economy, especially the financial sector. First up is W.P. Carey School Professor Lee McFeeters with the Arizona Outlook.
You've got to have a context for where we are with the economy. And historically, Arizona has been one of the stronger states during the recovery phase of most business cycles. But we went into this recession deeper. We went in earlier. We came out later. And basically, as we look into 2014, you would have to characterize it as still in recovery. I think that probably 2014 is going to be a little bit stronger than what we saw in 2013, but it is simply not going to be one of these breakout strong growth periods for Arizona.
What are the factors you look at, and what are the ones that you give most weight to?
The way we track the economy month by month is looking at employment growth, and that's a pretty good indicator of how everything else is going to be affected. Of course, jobs affect housing. Jobs create incomes. Incomes are used for spending, and that creates more jobs. Looking at job growth, what we see is that 2014 probably going to be perhaps maybe 2.5% job growth, which is really not all that great when you consider Arizona's long-term average job growth is much closer to 4%. So, you know, what we're looking at is an economy that's sort of running in low gear, half speed, however you want to characterize it. When you look at income, we see that income growth is particularly slow, partly related to the fact that some of these jobs are part-time jobs. You're not getting a full wage.
Because of how deep the recent recession was, do you see job growth a new normal as far as job growth is concerned, that even perhaps a good cycle is not going to be as good as we've seen in the past?
You know, I think that that is probably correct. Again, if you look back over the history of the last 4 or 5 decades, every rebound in the Arizona economy has been associated with so much slower growth. So, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, we would come just roaring out of a downturn at 6, 7, 8% growth. I think that certainly we can still look for 4% growth, I think, when the economy is really booming, but I think that's going to be about 3 years down the road in those categories.
You'll also be talking about the regional economy. Is there a situation that maybe there's a neighbor state that Arizona could adopt a policy from that might make things work better, or are the states so different that things like that wouldn't come into play?
Well, when you look across the West, we see that Texas is one of the stronger economies. One of your indicators, I guess, that would, you know, you would kind of get an idea of how things are across the West would be look at unemployment rates. Arizona's unemployment rate is basically what it was a year ago at this time, about 8.2, something in that range. California is even higher. Nevada is close to about 9.5%. So there's pockets really of unemployment in the West that are problematic. But in terms of growth, some of our neighbors are doing quite well. Utah, Colorado. But compared to other states, Arizona itself is doing quite well. According to our numbers, if you just look at where we rank, even with our 2% growth this year in employment, we're still going to be in the top 10 among all states for job growth. And looking across the West is pretty strong all the way from Washington down to Texas.
Do you think that economists were a little bit too optimistic in their projections based on the fact that Arizona has always bounced back so strongly, or were there some factors that people weren't quite looking at enough?
I think that last year at this time, there was quite a bit of optimism. A couple of things affected our forecast for 2013. One of them is that I think people kind of ignored the fact that we had a tax increase in 2013, that payroll tax that had been lowered temporarily, came back, and that affects consumers. That affected everybody. Furthermore, this uncertainty issue relating to the government, relating to the Affordable Care Act, I think that slowed down the economy. So I think that we were moderately optimistic last year at this time, but I think that the economy was even slightly more disappointing than anyone expected it to be. Now, as we look forward, though, there are sort of processes that are in place that are really going to improve the economy. Consumers are continuing to pay down debt, and just in terms of their need for appliances, automobiles, and so forth, there was such a long period where people were not buying that really there's pent-up demand that we expect to see. And going forward, we're expecting that population increases, inflows to the state will begin to improve. So all of that should give us some moderate optimism, I think, going into 2014.
Professor Lee McPheeters of ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business. For a look ahead at the 2014 national economy, I turn to James Glassman, Managing Director and Senior Economist for J.P. Morgan Chase. You say we should watch the financial markets for indicators of where the broader economy is going. Why is that?
The financial sector sort of reminds me, it's very similar to my Labrador Retriever. My lab is very good at picking up scents. I'll take him for a walk, and he's all of a sudden he's crisscrossing the path, and I know he's onto something, but I don't know what, and all of a sudden, lo and behold, a rabbit shoots out. And I think of the financial markets in the same way. I think, you know, these are financial markets are driven by investors. Some are very savvy, some are not, but we have a lot of information. People have a lot of different perspectives. And the financial markets, we learn as economists that they're very good at picking up trends that are taking shape in the economy. So what's most interesting right now is there still is a lot of worry about the economy because, frankly, it takes a long time to get out of recessions. That normally it takes 5 or 7 years, and this is a worse recession, so we can't be surprised if it takes longer. And yet here we are with stock prices at all-time record highs. Credit spreads have come down to normal levels. Interest rates are starting, you know, the Fed is doing a lot to hold down interest rates to nurture the recovery. But everything about the financial market is telling you that investors, where they put their money, are becoming much more confident that the economy is on the road to a full recovery. I don't find it confusing that the financial markets are way ahead of us, even though when you look around you, you still see all kinds of problems. But honestly, every day there are fewer and fewer problems, and there's more and more optimism popping up. And I think this is sort of what financial markets do. They, once they sense that the tide is shifting and is starting to move, come back in, it doesn't take very much to make you think, now, where is that high tide mark? Because that's where assets get valued. So, you know, if you're pessimistic, you've got to reconcile what it is that the markets are telling you. Some people think this is all about the Fed printing money. Honestly, this has got nothing to do with the Fed printing money. What the Fed is doing is nothing to do with what any of us ever learned in school. The Fed is not creating money. It's not monetizing assets. The reserve, the assets that it's buying, is creating an increase in reserves and the monetary base, and that's what a lot of people tend to take their cue from. But the truth is, the rise in monetary base and the rise in reserves is all accumulating as excess reserves. And what that means is the reserves that the Fed is creating as a part of this program to buy assets and try to keep rates down is not turning into money. Those reserves don't turn into money and therefore don't pump up asset values unless they're actually being borrowed. For those who see the Fed doing unusual things, they think that this must be what the stock market's about, but it's not. I mean, from my point of view, I'm looking at all, if I just totally tune out what the Fed is doing and I just think about the classic things that we all look to figure out, are we recovering or not? First, profits recover and stocks recover because they recognize that. And now layoffs are back to completely normal levels. And more important, every single one of our states is on the mend. We're all moving in the same direction. We're all swimming upstream.
Is this still a stock market that has had the broader participation perhaps a decade or so ago that we'd broader than we'd seen, really? It was less about institutional investing and less about some of the wealthier investors and more about maybe the average Joe, if I want to phrase it that way. Did the recession knock some of those people out, and will the market stay healthy enough without folks like that involved?
You know, I think if they're lucky, they didn't panic and pull money out of their IRAs. A lot of us have retirement money in our IRAs, which is hard to get out. Maybe you can move it out into, you know, less risky assets, but I think half of us actually have some exposure to the equity market through a lot of these retirement vehicles that are provided by our companies. So, I mean, it is true that small investors didn't seem to be participating that much in this equity revival that's taken place. They have been this year, but most of them were putting money more in the high yield bond funds, which is equity-like, in fact. It's probably true that equities are not held proportionately evenly across the country. Those who hold them benefit. The truth is there are indirect benefits to everybody, too, because as the market is improving, the cost of equity financing goes down. Companies encourages them to do more things. There's indirect effects that benefit everybody. So it's, you know, when you just look at the broad overall view trends and forget about how concentrated are the holdings, it does spill over to everybody in a direct or indirect way.
You mentioned that the states, all 50 states, are moving in the same direction, in a positive direction now. Do you see 2014 as a time when businesses clearly spend more, hire more?
I think once we get the fiscal uncertainty out of the way and if they're able to soften the sequestration cuts a bit, I think the mood will change a little more because, frankly, there's a couple big things that have been headwinds for the U.S. economy for the last couple of years. First of all, the European situation, that crisis over there really stalled the region. It's starting to turn, and now the European region is starting to pick up. Secondly, most of the real estate problems in the U.S. have been cleared, and home building business is on the way back, providing the support that they normally do. Thirdly, the government sector has really been a headwind in the last couple of years because we've been withdrawing all that fiscal stimulus that was put in place back in 2009 to cushion the economy. That's been a bit of a headwind, but as you look into 2014, that's expected to slowly wind down. So I think, you know, we've seen a fair amount of hiring by companies so far. My forecast itself is that next year is going to be a better year than this year. The economy is going to speed up a bit because of a lot of these things. Headwinds are dying down. And I think in that environment, the business community is going to be much more confident about investing in long-term projects, the kinds of things that really start to generate a fair amount of momentum. Probably the most important implication of all this, though, is it's the young people graduating from the class of 2008, 9, 10, 11, 12, who really had the most difficult time. And many of them, because they couldn't find jobs, just faded out. They're doing something else. Maybe parents are supporting them. Maybe they went back to school. And so far, a lot of the job growth has been focused on getting people who had been working, lost their jobs, were on unemployment benefits. Most of those are back in the market. Those are more seasoned, experienced workers. And I think we're entering a phase now, though, where companies are going to need to hire more, and they're going to be encouraged to go create more jobs for people who don't have the experience and the skills, the recent college grads. And I think that's what's changing now. You talk to people in the class of 2013, it's getting a little better, and there's a reason for that.
James Glassman, Managing Director and Senior Economist for J.P. Morgan Chase. He's in the Valley today for the 50th Annual Economic Forecast Luncheon, which is hosted by Chase and ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. How we use nuclear energy has been a controversial topic for years. Iran's potential to create a nuclear bomb led to years of sanctions. The aftermath of the damaged Fukushima Daiichi plant in Japan could take decades to clean up. But is increased nuclear energy a good option for the U.S. to consider to get away from a reliance on fossil fuels? Tomorrow at noon on ASU's Tempe campus, the Global Institute of Sustainability will host a panel called The Future of Nukes, Pandora's Promise or Peril. One of the participants is with me in studio. Jennifer Richter is visiting assistant professor at ASU School of Social Transformation and Consortium of Science, Policy and Outcomes. Jennifer, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So the argument that we're going to hear tomorrow has a lot to do with whether the use of nuclear energy is a safe option. You're someone who doesn't think it is. Why not?
Well, it's not necessarily whether it's safe or not. It's in what context it should be used appropriately in society. And energy systems are just that. They're just energy systems. Mm. But what they really are a way of embedding our social values into different technological systems. So the goal here isn't just to produce more energy. The question is for whom, why, where, how do we appropriately access and distribute that kind of energy? How do we distribute the risks and the benefits of that energy source? And all of those questions need to be answered while you're actually producing the energy or before you even implement that energy source, not after the fact. And so the idea of increasing nuclear when we haven't solved some of these existential questions that continue to circulate, how do we deal with uranium mine tailings piles? How do we deal with nuclear waste? How do we access this kind of energy and attach it to the grid? Those kinds of questions still remain. And so one of the issues here isn't just the production of energy, it's what kind of society are we envisioning with this type of energy. And so the goal here is maybe more just, sustainable, and resilient societies rather than just energy production.
Yeah, the film Pandora's Promise will be screened tomorrow night at 7 at the Valley Art in Tempe. And it seems to be a film that is being portrayed as one where a lot of folks who were, I don't want to say afraid of nuclear, but were perhaps anti-nuclear to some extent, have changed sides on that. Since we don't have our other guests with us at the moment. Can you explain that? What you saw from the film, what were the arguments made?
Pandora's Promise is a really fascinating film, and it's very polarizing, in my view. It's very, you're either with us or against us. You're pro or you're anti. And I don't think that's a particularly useful place for these kind of debates to occur. There's a lot of gray area between there. People might be more resigned to nuclear power. They may be accepting of it up to a point. They may be concerned about a few things that are attendant to that particular energy source. And so to posit that you either have to be for it or against it, you know, if you're an environmentalist, you have to be for nuclear energy, it puts people in these uncomfortable boxes, I think, that are unnecessary to this particular discussion. And I think the film is very much populated by people who were fervently anti-nuclear for a lot of their lives and are now coming around to be fervently pro-nuclear. And it's an interesting polarization of their own attitude that may not be reflected in the larger populace for many good reasons.
You're not there. Perhaps you'll never be there. What would it take, some of the questions that you talked about as far as taking care of nuclear waste, if there could be some sort of way of taking care of that that you were satisfied with, would you change a little bit?
Well, nuclear waste is only one condition of this problem, right? It's indicative of a lot of the issues that plague nuclear, that we're going to produce this energy source without thinking it all the way through, without finding these different ways of dealing with every attendant concern. And so if nuclear waste, if there could be a solution, that solution would have to take into account a lot of different issues, and those issues haven't been resolved yet. This is the reason we don't have a permanent nuclear waste repository for spent nuclear fuel rods. And there are some issues, you know, being put forth, but this is actually one of the most integral things about nuclear power. It requires time, it requires patience, it requires careful thought, it requires a comprehensive manner of thinking about a particular energy system. And nuclear isn't quite there yet, right? And we've had 70 years to think about it, and yet we still are thinking, according to the latest Blue Ribbon Commission report to the Secretary of Energy, that by 2048, he's saying that we will finally have a nuclear waste repository. And we started this project in 1944, right? We started detonating bombs in 1945. So 100 years. And that seems about right. You know, if you're going to produce something that's going to be toxic to humans and the environment for millennia, hundreds of millennia, it's worth taking the time to do it correctly.
I recognize the absurdity of this question even before I ask it. But is there a feeling that so much emphasis has been put on horrible situations like what happened in Fukushima? Can it be argued that was a freak incident in a sense because of what was related to it? Would we be in the same kind of dangers in the U.S. if something like that happened?
Well, freak incidents are inherent to the way that we've created our society, right? We have this energy system that is pretty safe most of the time. But when things go wrong with nuclear, they tend to go very, very wrong. And then, again, how we deal with that emergency situation reveals all the vulnerabilities in our social system. It's not about the technology, it's about how we react to it. And you're never going to program out human nature from humans, right? There's no technology that can solve humans. And so the idea, again, reducing this to energy output is one of those problems. What's most fascinating, and this was something that I found troubling about the film, too, was this constant reliance on mortality rates as the harbinger of success or failure for nuclear. And what Fukushima Daiichi, that incident there, what that revealed is that what really is being produced beyond mortality, beyond illness, is uncertainty. Mm. It's this idea that we can't trust our government, we can't trust the industry to give us the correct information about what happened, and now people feel like they can't trust their soil, they can't trust their water, they can't trust the food that they're eating, they can't trust that the safety of future generations is secured here. And that constant production of uncertainty is what really undermines these democratic institutions, right? If you can't trust in your government, you can't trust in industry, you can't trust in each other, mm-hmm. what are you left with ultimately? And so nuclear is this unique kind of energy source that really very suddenly tends to undermine that. And that's true with Three Mile Island, with Chernobyl, with lots of other smaller nuclear incidents that we've had in this country as well.
If nuclear were, again, ridiculous, problem-free, what are the advantages of nuclear energy compared to some others?
Well, nuclear can be very efficiently done, mm-hmm. and it does. One of the most amazing statistics that I've come across in my research is that nuclear energy has provided about 20% of America's electricity source for the last 30 years, and that number hasn't changed despite the fact that we haven't increased the amount of nuclear power plants in the country. And that speaks to the sort of increased efficiency within the nuclear power plant itself. Mm-hmm. And so nuclear does have some of these very interesting, very positive benefits to it. But the idea here, and you know, one of the things that Pandora's Promise raises is the idea that we can make new technologies, thorium reactors, small modular reactors, things like that. But does that actually solve the world's energy problem? Or is that just solving the nuclear industry's problems, right? And that's something that is a much less striking sort of argument. But the idea that we can make that 20% even better without taking anything else off the table is, to me, much more intriguing than saying we're going to solve all of the world's problems with an energy source.
Those who have become more pro-nuclear, those who we said at the beginning were anti-nuclear, have talked about the idea of climate change. And less reliance on fossil fuels could help us when it comes to that. What are your thoughts?
Climate change is definitely one type of tool that needs to be in the arsenal of addressing climate change. But it can't take the place of the social, cultural, political, and economic factors that are at play here, too. Like, just producing more nuclear energy doesn't address any of those issues. And I just saw a report this morning about Phoenix, that Phoenix has reduced its fossil fuel emissions in 7.2% in the last 4 years. And that wasn't because we built more nuclear power plants or even produced any more energy. It's through efficiency, it's through alternative fuels, it's infrastructure programs, things like that are what really helped bring that down in a much more short amount of time than they were predicting at the beginning. So addressing how we live our lives, how we use energy, is much more important. I think the promise of nuclear has always been that if we just produce more energy, we don't have to change anything about our consumption patterns. We can just keep on living the way we're living, use what we use, without ever addressing the root issue, which is that the way we live was really dependent on cheap, plentiful energy with no sense of the consequences. And so that's a very strange message, I think, to be putting out at this point. It will take everything. We, of course, have to look at how our globe is being produced, how we are using things, how we are using natural resources. All of that has to be addressed at a very fundamental level. And nuclear is just one little piece of that.
Are you concerned that a film like Pandora's Promise might shift the momentum, that it may, in fact, be something where people jump on board and say, wow, I'd like nuclear to be this easy. This sounds great.
It could, but people will quickly run into the problems that have already prevented nuclear from becoming a much more largely exposed energy source, which is that it costs a lot of money to build a nuclear power plant. It costs even more money to try and build a brand new kind of nuclear power plant. And then to make sure that it's safe, again, takes time and patience, takes 10 years to build these kinds of plants, to design them. The R&D is really extensive. And again, to make sure that it's safe for society is a huge part of that. We could invest billions of dollars into a new thorium reactor and then find out that it's not usable on the scale that we want to use it for. It could just be this boutique kind of nuclear technology. And if that happens, we're right back at square one. And meanwhile, that can actually happen. You can spend 30 years getting thorium reactors onto a commercial market and, you know, spend billions of dollars doing that. But meanwhile, there are other options, too. The renewable market is growing leaps and bounds. It's important enough that Arizona has its own net metering controversy right now, right? So something's going on there. So those different options all have to be, you know, invested in at the same time so that people can have these different, and people, I think, want different options, right? They don't want to go with the same monolithic structure that's dominated our energy system, our energy grid for the last 60 years.
But we don't like to think it would be that easy. And even the idea of being patient with nuclear, people also have to be patient when it comes to the renewable energies as well.
Right.
Where's the big question to close here, Jen? What's the combination? What does it need to look like? Can we afford as a society to have a little bit of each? I mean, we want that, but can we actually put that together and make that manageable?
You know, I'm a very optimistic person. I absolutely believe that humans, when push comes to shove, will find ways to do things. We're an ingenious species. Look, we created nuclear power, for God's sake. This is amazing. And nuclear's not going anywhere. That's 20%. Renewables will continue to climb. And nuclear and renewables, all of the other sort of exotic fuels, will have to come together to take out more of the coal piece of the pie, more of the fossil fuel piece of the pie, and that will address climate change. And meanwhile, we need to examine how we live our lives at a very fundamental level, too, to address more of these issues in a more comprehensive and timely manner.
Jennifer Richter is visiting assistant professor at ASU School of Social Transformation and Consortium of Science, Policy, and Outcomes. She's on the panel tomorrow at noon on ASU's Tempe campus. It's called The Future of Nukes, Pandora's Promise or Peril, and the film Pandora's Promise will be screened tomorrow night at 7 at the Valley Art in Tempe. Jen, thanks for the time.
Thank you so much.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll find out whether Phoenix has somehow become cool. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by the law firm of Stinson, Morris & Hecker, LLP. With attorneys in Phoenix and across the country, Stinson helps clients with their most critical business and litigation matters. On the web at Stinson.com.
Good morning. You're listening to Here and Now on KJZZ. We should see cloudy skies in Phoenix today. We've got a 30% chance of showers this afternoon, and we're on our way to a high of 63 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight with a low of 45. Stay with us at 12 o'clock for NPR's Here and Now from Boston. Rescue crews are trying to help a pod of pilot whales stranded in the Florida Everglades. And as more people work past retirement age, we'll hear about a 71-year-old Vietnam veteran working as a contractor in Afghanistan. Here and Now starts at noon on KJZZ. Cloudy skies and 62 degrees in Phoenix right now. It's 11:45.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. In recent months, we've talked about whether the Valley is a good place for artists and the so-called creative class. We've asked if Phoenix is a malleable, newer place where newcomers can comfortably try to change what they don't like. But we've avoided the most direct question, one that's pretty relevant to a lot of the population. Is Phoenix cool? Phoenix New Times managing editor Amy Silverman wrote the paper's cover story on Phoenix's Cool Index, and she joins me now. Hi, Amy. Good morning.
Hey, Steve.
So, is Phoenix cool? Please say yes.
Ooh, it's such a tough question. I think there's an even more important question that I realized when I was reporting the story, which is, do we have to ask the question anymore? I think we're really to the point where we don't, where people feel a lot more confident about living here and confident in what they're doing here, and it doesn't really matter as much.
Okay, well,
are we cool by a Portland, Oregon standard? Or a Brooklyn, New York standard? No. But do you care?
Well, I don't. You and I have both spent basically most of our lives here. So for us, I don't know if we even, you know, we were sort of born here, and so we kind of have to feel that, well, whether it's cool or not, we're going to stay here.
Ooh, I couldn't wait to get out at one point.
Well, I was going to ask you that. Okay, at what point?
For a long time, I didn't want to be here.
Okay.
and I struggled with it. I've written about it for New Times and other places over the years. You know, it's interesting. I had a conversation a couple weeks ago with a woman named Taz Lumens, who you guys have talked to. And Taz is a really great person. She was an architect here in Phoenix recently. She left for Oregon. And we had a discussion about Phoenix and why she left. And I hung up the phone with her, and I thought, I love it here. I am so happy that I stayed. There is something so freeing and wonderful about, I mean, first of all, you and I are lucky because it's our home, but there's also something wonderful about being in a place that it just doesn't have to try so hard. It doesn't have much to live up to in a really good way. And actually, I would argue that in the last 10 years, we've developed a lot, a whole lot more than we had. And there are a lot more people staying than going, more important people staying than going. And that was really the point of the story that I wrote.
Yeah, the people you profiled, you picked out a dozen people and you went down your list and then they've all stayed. Give people some insight on that. If they haven't read the piece, your cover story in the New Times, were there similar reasons for staying? Were they completely different reasons for staying?
I don't think anybody really gave it much thought because they are all so busy working on their work, on what they're working on here. I mean, Cindy Dash and Greg Esser are a good example. I think that probably 15, 12 years or so ago, they were both really hell-bent on leaving. And then I turned around one day and they had bought the building on Roosevelt Row that became iLounge, that became one of the anchors for Roosevelt Row. And I'm sure they've thought about leaving since, but those two are so busy now. Greg now runs an international artist program at ASU. Cindy is a co-owner of Changing Hands Bookstore. They're getting ready to open a second store in Central Phoenix. She and Greg run Roosevelt Row, and she runs an art boutique as well. I get exhausted just thinking about what they do. Those two don't have time to read Richard Florida's work. They don't have time to worry about whether or not the city is cool. They've made it into what they want it to be. That's what they're doing. That's what the people on this list of 12 have been busy doing.
Are these folks that had similar attitudes? Perhaps they were not as angst-ridden as some of us and just decided, hey, this is where I'm at, so I am going to shape it into what works for me?
No, I think some are angst-ridden, and I asked several, almost all of them, if they thought Phoenix was cool or not, and the answers were really across the board. Some of them thought that Phoenix had arrived. Some of them thought that Phoenix was always cool and never had anything to worry about. And quite a few said, no, not really, not yet.
Well, how do you define cool, if we come back to that?
That's a really good question. It's that thing that you can't nail to the wall that makes you know that you want to be in a place. You know, Richard Florida, who's this kind of urban planning guru who New Times brought out to Phoenix 10 years ago, the city hired him. He wrote a book about what he calls the creative class, and he argued that you really needed to do whatever you could to draw the creative class to your inner city or your city was going to fail. He said, if you have to ask if you're cool or not, you're definitely not cool.
Okay. Now, for creatives, coming back to the creative class concept, how many of them do you think have come because Phoenix is so malleable, as I mentioned? They can make it into what they want to be. There is less, you know, we've had fights with people about whether there's enough history in Phoenix or not, but clearly it doesn't have as much as Philadelphia or Boston or something like that.
I do think that people come here to do that, but I think more than that, there are people like Wayne Rainey, who runs Mon Orchid, a gallery on Roosevelt Row, who've been here all their lives, or Sloan McFarland, who co-owns the buildings for Lux and Pane Bianco are, and he has this Your Land project farther south. They've been here all along, and they really see how far the city has come and what they have already been able to do with it and what they can do moving forward. I think it's an insider's game to a large extent. I think it's probably hard to look from the outside and figure it out. I thought that about Phoenix forever, though, that it's a very hard city to figure out when you land here.
Yeah, and again, you've been here for a long time. I want to come back to when you were tempted to leave. Was that a young woman's idea, thinking she needs to get away from her family, or did you really just not want to be here anymore?
Oh, I think that was at birth.
Okay.
from the time I was little, my parents would stick the black and white TV in my room on Saturday nights and have dinner parties, and I'd watch Mary Tyler Moore and Bob Newhart and think, I want to wear a knit cap and throw it in the air, and I want to live in a big high-rise, and even All in the Family looked good to me. I just wanted to be somewhere else. I think growing up a liberal Jew in the Arcadia neighborhood in the 1980s was really not the best fit. And so I did. I left several times in my early 20s. Never meant to come back, but I did.
Amy, let's come back quickly to the insider's game concept. With so many people who are transplants, it seems like that would have changed, this idea that it's still an insider's game to some extent. Is it a different kind of insider's game? It's no longer the folks like Eugene Pulliam. It's more of the folks in the creative class and the artist level?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Wayne Rainey made this argument, I think, in my story that, you know, Phoenix is one of the few places where you don't need to have a famous name in order to make it big. And so I don't think it has anything to do with having money or having a name or any kind of reputation, anything like that. I think it's being able to realize what the city's potential is. I think you and I can look at it and know what it used to be and what it is now and what it can become. And someone coming in, it just might be a little bit harder to figure that out. I mean, yeah, there are plots of land that are empty. Mm-hmm. But in terms of what is really needed culturally, I think it's hard to come in and just figure that out.
Amy, less than a minute or so, I wonder, with Phoenix's history, quirky or not, some restaurants that people love, some places that people used to hang out, can a place be cool and combine some of that history, or does it have to sort of give itself over to the new generation?
Oh, I think that the history is a big part of what makes Phoenix cool if it is. Our Best of Phoenix issue this year for New Times was a vintage theme. And so we went back and looked at a lot of old businesses that are still here, places like Durant's, that really give the city its character and its color and complement the new places coming in. You can't have one without the other. You have to celebrate the old and bring in the new. And adaptive reuse is really what has made Phoenix so much better in the last 10 years. And Kimber Lanning and others deserve a lot of credit for that.
Amy Silverman is managing editor of the Phoenix New Times. She wrote the paper's most recent cover story on Phoenix's Cool Index. Amy, thanks as always.
Thank you, Steve. Take care.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. One of the most traditional performances for the holiday season is the Nutcracker. You probably know the story. A young girl named Clara receives a nutcracker as a Christmas gift. She's awakened at midnight by a battle between life-size soldier toys and large mice in army uniforms, and soon she's traveling to the snow forest and watching the Sugar Plum Fairy. An offbeat tale, no doubt, and the creativity of Ballet Arizona's artistic director Eve Anderson makes the performance even more dramatic. Eve Anderson joins me now. You've been involved as artistic director at Ballet Arizona for a number of years, so you've choreographed the Nutcracker many, many times. What stands out about it for you?
It really is the score of Tchaikovsky, which is, even though, you know, I've heard it since I was like 11 years old, every year, and spent, you know, actually years doing Nutcracker, it still is an extraordinary score. That's sort of what keeps you going. It's Tchaikovsky. Tchaikovsky, you know, wore his heart all over his body, I would say. It's music that goes right to the core of one's being, you know. And it hits you in such a way, you know. I mean, but Tchaikovsky does that. But I would say with Nutcracker even more so, because it's also a very diverse score. I mean, there's so much in it. I mean, it's an extraordinary score, just extraordinary. And there's so much beautiful, beautiful music, and so much there's so much life in it, you know?
What about your choreography? Is there something that you change year to year to liven it up for yourself, or is there sort of a standard Nutcracker choreography?
I haven't changed too much. The thing that changes is I think we have better dancers now. So you actually see the choreographer more clearly than you may be used to. I mean, I tend to choreograph in a... It's not very easy to dance. It's very demanding, technically. And since we have better dancers now, I would say things look more like what I intended it to look like.
Is there something you find with the new dancers, with the better dancers? Are they, as people who maybe have enjoyed it since they were 11 or less than that, that they look forward to doing this? Are they excited about seeing the bigger crowds, for example?
I mean, the funny thing actually is that I think most dancers actually enjoy doing Nutcracker, which I'm kind of surprised at, because... But they don't have to watch it every night, you know. First of all, you're not in the ballet, you know, from beginning to end. You do certain parts, and it's a very different thing. And then, you know, it's around Christmas, and it's around, and the audience is a different audience than our normal audience. And there's a spirit, you know, usually during Nutcracker. People that come to the theater, there's sort of a kind of excitement that is different than when our normal audience, I would say. So in that sense, I mean, it does have a very special feel to it.
As you said, the audience for the Nutcracker is a little bit different than some of Ballet Arizona's other shows. You have a lot more kids there. Is Nutcracker a good way for kids to access ballet? Do you find that kids get inspired by Nutcracker to go into ballet?
Children for sure can see other things and be equally, you know, excited about. I mean, we just did Cinderella, and one of the things that which is Prokofiev's music, which is sort of, you know, not necessarily so easy music. But what I liked about that, there was quite a bit of kids, and there were actually, and it's a funny ballet, certain parts are. What I liked about that, there were so many kids that were laughing. You heard all these young laughs. I thought that was pretty cool. So, I mean, obviously it got to them, and they sort of understood it, and they had some kind of experience. So, yes, you know, anything is possible.
Ebe Anderson, he's the artistic director of Ballet Arizona. The company starts its performances of the Nutcracker this Friday night, December the 6th, with the Phoenix Symphony at Symphony Hall. And that's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks very much to Nick Blumberg for his help on today's program. Thank you very much for listening. If you want to hear this program again or other segments from our past editions, go online to kjzz.org later this afternoon. Now we head back to Boston for NPR's Here and Now on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. We hope you have a great day. It's 12 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by St. Vincent de Paul, continuing to feed, clothe, house, and heal the increasing number of struggling families and individuals in need. Donations to help St. Vincent de Paul help others at 602-266-